The FT.
Getting cold feet about a place in the sun. Why Brits are rushing to sell their holiday homes. A new year means new pension rules. We explain what you can do now and after April. And with 17 months to repay at 0% interest, are credit cards becoming more attractive? All this to come in this week's FT Money Show. I'm Matthew Vincent. I'll be giving you the lowdown on all of these money matters in downloadable form with my colleagues from FT Money, Tanya Poley.
Hello.
Alice Ross.
Hello.
And Steve Lodge.
Hello.
And our special studio guest, Dave Roberts, Senior Consultant at Towers Watson.
Hello.
So let's start with the money news. This week, with the January TV schedules already interspersed with countless holiday adverts, new research suggests that one type of holidaymaker is giving up on going abroad, the Brit with a holiday home in Europe. According to currencies.co.uk, a leading foreign exchange broker, more than half of its clients with holiday homes in the Eurozone are considering selling in 2011 due to falling rental income and currency volatility. Last year, more than a third of homeowners who let out an overseas property said occupancy rates and rental income were down on what they had expected, and the fluctuating value of the euro only made the uncertainty worse. So, Tanya, do you think this is likely to become a widespread trend this year?
Well, I have spoken to a number of other currency brokers, and they seem to all be saying that they've seen a similar trend. One broker, Smart Currency Exchange, said over the second half of 2010 compared to the second half of 2009, they had an increase of over 50% of people actually bringing back euros back into UK. And they're saying they see this is going to be something that's going to continue to happen in 2011 as well. And also HighFX, another currency broker, one of the leading ones, has also said that they've seen a big increase in the number of people doing the same, and also dollars to sterling as well.
Right. So it would seem that the dream of the place in the sun, has turned into a bit of a nightmare for some people because, I suppose, of the general economic downturn, but also this volatility in foreign exchange markets.
Yeah, I think the worst of it was probably in 2008, 2009, when we saw currency volatility like at its worst, and like pound was obviously weakening a lot against the euro. And I think it's been a case of obviously people have had to transfer a lot more of their sterling to actually meet all those kind of mortgage costs abroad, like the maintenance costs of the property and taxes, various different things. So obviously there's kind of the feeling that they don't really know, there's this big uncertainty of how much they will have to like transfer over. And I guess also with the latest Eurozone crisis, there's also this concern that prices are going to keep on falling in places like Spain, Portugal, it could spread to Italy. France isn't so bad. I think people are a bit more confident about France and property prices. But I think there's kind of the feeling that it's got so bad that they just can't meet the cost anymore.
And those countries that you mentioned, Spain, Portugal, Italy, are those the countries where the sell-off is expected to take place?
Yeah, according to currencies.co.uk, they said it's basically France has been, they've seen about 40% of people transferring money back, while Spain's been about 35%. So those seem to be the two main countries where people are actually, selling up and going back home.
And is this happening across the board? You know, is this happening to the person with the massive villa in Tuscany, as well as the person with a small flat in the Costa del whatever?
Yeah, it's much more those sort of middle and lower value homes, really. It's those people who have a holiday home that they kind of often rent out to kind of meet the costs of actually owning that property. It's because the rental market we've seen kind of like completely kind of destroyed over the last few years. Obviously, people can't afford to go abroad as much, and we're seeing actually a lot more people holidaying in the UK. So they've had this drop of actually occupancy rates. They're not getting as much rental income because of, or they've obviously had to put their rates down as well. So it's those people really who rely on that rental income, and much more rather than those people who are wealthy who don't tend to rent out their properties as much.
So presumably the advice is, if you're going to buy or keep a holiday home, allow for quite a lot of fluctuation in your income.
Yeah, and it's also worth thinking about things like forward contracts. So once the exchange rate is at a point where you think, actually, that's good for me, and you're concerned that maybe the pound might fall further, lock it in then for like a 12-month period or two-year period. And that could possibly help you, actually, in terms of factoring the costs involved.
And that's something you can do through a foreign exchange broker?
Yes, yeah.
Good advice. Thank you very much for that, Tanya. And for more on the Great British Holiday Home sell-off, look out for Tanya's news story in the money section of this weekend's FT and on our website at ft.com/money. Still to come on the show, are credit cards becoming a more efficient way to manage your debt? First, though, pensions. This year, we'll see the introduction of new rules on pension contributions, which are intended to simplify the system and make it easier for us to know how much we are able to pay in to boost our retirement income. But with the rule change not happening until April, anyone who has made pension planning a New Year resolution will have two sets of rules to deal with. And if high earners make a mistake and pay in too much, they could be stuck with two separate tax charges. As a result, pension advisers are telling senior executives to get their affairs in order before the new limits come into effect in 4 months' time. Alice, by the sounds of it, 2011 is going to be a bit of a complex year for any pension saver who's trying to boost their retirement planning.
It will be, and it's because we've got these two conflicting systems. So the previous government, the Labour government, had intended to simplify the system in a different way. And then the coalition government came in and said, actually, we're going to scrap your idea and we're going to bring in our new idea. But because that's not coming in until April, we still have the high earners who were subject to restrictions under the Labour rules are still subject to those restrictions. So we've kind of got these two things going on at once. Now I'm here with Dave Roberts at Towers Watson. Dave, you'd think that the advice would be for people to put as much as possible into their pension before April, because of course the annual allowance is coming down from $255,000 a year to $50,000 a year. But it's not that simple, is it, unfortunately?
Unfortunately not, no. I mean, there are two distinct groups of individuals, and unfortunately, again, the second group subdivides into further groups. But fundamentally, for individuals who have earned less than £130,000 in the current or previous tax year, they're not subject to the provisions that were put in place by the Labour government to deter people from bringing forward pension savings. So these individuals can pay in up to £255,000 this year without any tax charge. There is a caveat around that, which is that they can only do so if their pension input period ends before the 6th of April next year. Now, a pension input period is normally a 12-month period. The default is that it ends on the anniversary of when you first started paying contributions, but the period can be brought forward. So there are ways in which individuals who haven't been making savings or haven't been making savings up to that £255,000 could do so, but they need to establish that there is a pension input period that ends before the 6th of April.
Okay, so if you earn under £130,000, check when your pension input period of your company pension scheme is. If it's before the 6th of April, you can pay in up to £255,000. So you're having a good year until April. But if you earn over £130,000, the situation is more complicated, isn't it? Because you may have been restricted already to £20,000 this year.
That's right. If you're a £130,000 earner or more, you are subject to provisions that were put in place to deter you from increasing your pension contributions. Now, you can continue to make pensions contributions, pension savings, at the same rate as you have been making. So that's even if it's more than £20,000. But if you try to increase your contributions, then the maximum, including the old level of contributions, can't exceed £20,000. So, in effect, most people will not be considering increasing their pension contributions before 6th of April.
And so for these people, the new rules are a good thing because they can now go up from £20,000 a year to £50,000 a year from April. So that's good news for them, I guess.
Certainly for some of them, it will be good news, yes. Or at the very least, it will offer them more scope than they've had over the last 2 years. So if they wish to make pension contributions of up to £50,000 and they do so in a pension input period that ends next year, that's fine. However, if individuals are making pension savings of more than £50,000, because bear in mind they could have done so provided that they didn't increase their pension savings, then they will need to bring their pension savings down. Mm. Now, within a defined contribution arrangement, that's relatively straightforward because it's clear the amount of savings that have been put into the pension. It's just like a savings pot. But if they're a member of a defined benefit pension scheme, then a value has to be placed on their pension accrual over the tax year. Now, we had thought, because when the proposals were first mooted back in July, that actually this could impact a lot of people who are earning certainly significantly less than the previous government's proposals would have caught, sort of down to levels of £60,000-£70,000 a year if they were in a final salary pension scheme with significant service. But because of the way that the proposals, or because of the way that the new rules will work, because every £1 of pension accrual will be valued at £16, and because actually it will be possible to carry forward unused allowances from the previous 3 years, that actually means that it's not going, or the rules aren't going to come quite so far down the income distribution as had been feared. And so you're looking at individuals, possibly £70,000 to £100,000, shouldn't be or are unlikely to be affected.
OK. Let's say that you don't want to pay in more than you should, basically. You've got all of these rules going on. Maybe you're subject to 20,000 cap, maybe you're subject to 50,000 cap. How do you find this out, and how can you avoid paying in too much? Do you have to basically talk to your company, talk to your kind of pension scheme trustee and get them to tell you what the situation is?
Yes, I mean, the things that you need to know are, when does my pension input period end? Because you need to know whether it ends before the new rules come in or afterwards. You obviously need to know your earnings to see whether you're already affected by the provisions that are in place now to deter increases. And you need to know actually the pension savings that are being made. And that will normally mean, certainly in defined benefit arrangements, going to your pension provider, your pension scheme, and actually asking them for the information. Some will already have communicated or will be communicating with their members shortly to try to filter out people so that those who are unlikely to be troubled by these aren't unnecessarily worried by them.
So, yes, go and find out exactly when your pension input period ends. There's a New Year resolution for everyone. Thanks very much for that, Dave and Alice. And for a full explanation of the new rules and top tips on getting your pension in order now, you can read Alice's special feature in the Money section of this weekend's FT and on our website, ft.com/money. And finally today, credit cards. Barclaycard has just launched what it claims is the longest ever 0% balance transfer deal, giving 17 months to pay off existing debts transferred to a new card. But there is, of course, a catch, the small matter of a 2.9% transfer fee, which means it's not exactly free money. So is this the return of healthy competition to the credit card market, or just another way to make money from indebted consumers? Steve, you've been having a look at credit cards and the most attractive rates available right now. What's your take on the state of the market?
Well, Matthew, traditionally in the new year, you do see credit card companies come up with these, what are really debt consolidation offers. So this is the longest ever at 0%. So for people who have got a so-called debt hangover or debt leftovers from overdoing it at Christmas, this could make sense. But it's not just in the debt consolidation market that credit cards are becoming or have become very attractive. We're now back to pre-credit crisis sort of levels of generosity in terms of the sort of rewards and interest-free credit offers on spending.
And in terms of some of these rewards and incentives, what are the best ones now offering?
One that many industry watchers like is the American Express Platinum Card, which to new customers offers a very high 5% cashback rate on spending. That only lasts 3 months, and the maximum cashback they can give you is £100. So it's a maximum of £2,000 of spending. But in addition, there's 6 months of interest-free credit from the time you take the card out as well. So it could make sense for someone buying a big-ticket item in the January sales. For example, Mrs. Lodge's £550 Mulberry handbag could go on this sort of card. And I would get 5% back on that, so some reward for my spending. And in addition, I'd be able to spread that debt burden over 6 months with bearing no interest.
Sound like you've thought this through very, very, very carefully. That sounds like quite a good combination of incentive and interest-free period. Of course, transferring a balance to a new card will incur a transfer fee. And some of these can be fairly significant, can't they?
Yes. So there are these two distinct markets. I mean, many listeners will be these traditionally full payers, but they may well already be using some sort of reward card and may see a benefit in taking advantage, if you like, of the cash flow benefits of an interest-free credit offer on purchases. The offer you're referring to, where there is actually a charge, is where you're transferring a debt. And yes, the Barclaycard offer is 2.9%. There is, for very large transfers, there's a rebate of £20 if you transfer over £3,000. But overwhelmingly and slightly oddly, people would say these so-called 0% offers do have this transfer fee, and that's levied at the outset as well. So it's a hit, or it's an increase on your debt. So it will suit some people, but not others.
Exactly. So the Barclay Card one is the longest interest-free period. What's the next best? Are there some with lower transfer fees, or is 2.9 about average?
They're all typically about 2-3%, but we can expect competition in this area. Just like in the savings market, it's a very internet-oriented market now, so the way that providers get at the top of the best buy tables is by improving their offer by a smidgen. So Barclaycard here has improved its offer from 60 months at 0% to 70 months. There are still other cards at 60 months. But these are as long as 0% offers have ever been. In the old days, when there weren't these transfer fees, and this, you'd have to go back 5 years realistically, the best interest-free offers then for this, what they used to call credit card tarting, moving your balance around just to basically benefit from 0% money for years in some cases, those offers were typically less than a year. So, but we can expect further competition probably in the next week or so. I would expect people are saying the MBNA, a particularly aggressive credit card provider, might come up with an offer which has a lower fee, for example.
We'll look out for that in the coming weeks. Thanks very much for that, Steve. And if you'd like to know Steve's six best buy cards for different types of borrower, look out for his analysis piece in the money section of this weekend's FT. But that's all for this week's FT Money Show. Remember, you will find weekday news updates and all of these stories on our website, ft.com/money. And if you have a question that you'd like us to answer about any aspect of your finances, just email us. The address is money@ft.com. Next week, we'll bring you another financial lowdown in downloadable form. But until then, it's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from Steve, Tanya, Alice, and our special studio guest, Dave Roberts from Towers Watson.
Goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.